welcome to NewsHour live from the BBC World Service. I'm Rebecca Kesby in London and James Kumarasamy is in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. And James, Wisconsin is one of the seven key swing states we keep hearing about in this election. It's worth 10 electoral college votes, so it's not as big a prize as maybe North Carolina or, of course, Pennsylvania. But you've been travelling all over the state over the past few days, visiting lots of different communities. What's got you so interested in this particular local showdown, and why Milwaukee today?
Well, Rebecca, it always comes down to the food, doesn't it? We're in Solly's. It's a diner in the north of Milwaukee. The locals here enjoying steaming cups of coffee, hearty breakfasts, although the speciality later in the day will be butter burgers, which, as their name implies, add a dollop of Wisconsin's dairy heritage to a variety of bun and patty combos. This is the biggest city in a state that's gone by a sliver to the winner of the last two presidential elections, and it's likely to play a very important role once again. The Democrats, they're counting on a big turnout in the centre of Milwaukee and making further inroads into the Republican-leaning suburbs. Both Republican Donald Trump and Democrat Kamala Harris have been to this city in recent days. Kamala Harris, she's spending her final day of campaigning in Pennsylvania. Donald Trump dividing his time between Pennsylvania, Michigan and North Carolina. He's promising to fix the economy and the immigration system. Now, more than 75 million Americans have already voted early by post or in person, although there are still tens of millions yet to choose. And according to the opinion polls, immigration is one of the main issues on their mind. Last month, NewsHour's James Menendez reported on how that has played out on the U.S.-Mexican border. It's also had an impact here in Wisconsin, 2,500 kilometres away, though. Over the last couple of years, nearly 1,000 undocumented migrants, mostly from Nicaragua and Venezuela, have arrived in Whitewater. It's a small college town, an hour or so drive from here. Some people have raised the alarm about pressure on local schools. The police chief there wrote a letter to the White House asking for more resources, and it caught the eye of Donald Trump, who name-checked the town on the campaign trail.
Look no further than the small town of Whitewater, Wisconsin. Does anybody know Whitewater? After being inundated with Biden migrants, this tiny town now has a budget shortfall of over $400,000. Their public schools are straining with hundreds of new migrant students who don't speak a word of English. Their police force is being diverted from traffic stops to migrant crime, our favorite new term, migrant crime. It's a new category of crime. And their town is becoming a hotbed of cartel activity and illicit drugs like nobody's ever even envisioned before.
Well, I've been to Whitewater to see the impact of immigration on one small town that's become caught up in the national debate. At the homecoming parade in Whitewater, the local university's marching band, dressed in swing state purple, sashays down Main Street, followed by feathered mascot Willie Warhawk in the back of an open-top car. Among those watching this traditional celebration of the local football team, Councillor Brienne Brown. She's running for the Wisconsin State Assembly as a Democrat this year, but it was during a previous election campaign that she noticed how the town was changing.
During the pandemic, I was knocking on doors, and a lot of the housing that usually housed students, people speaking Spanish, were answering the doors. There's one guy from Venezuela and another few guys from Nicaragua, so we probably got 50 people here during the pandemic. But as chain migration happens, you get a good job and you have a roof over your head, you're going to send the word home, hey, this is a good place to live. So little by little, more people started showing up, and that's when the police started noticing right around 2021 was because it was a very, very cold day and they found a family living in a barn. And that's when they realized something was going on because they'd also started pulling over more immigrants who were in their cars, but they didn't have driver's licenses. So that's when they started realizing they did not have the resources to deal with some really minor infractions. And that's when it got really frustrating because instead of it being elected officials helping us with resources, it was elected officials turning it into a circus and wanting to discuss with the news how terrible Whitewater was.
People here feel about becoming this totemic town?
We're pretty angry about it. The majority of people here are very stoic and kind and would like to just make things work. And to have people throwing bombs at us, I mean, for instance, the first time this happened, neo-Nazis from Illinois came up to our university campus and put Nazi signs all over our campus. And they said on their Facebook page they did it because of the immigrants. Like, they are actually making us a target for people who don't even live here.
Good morning. My name is Henry Kinson. I grew up in Whitewater.
Henry is a local businessman and former school board member who gave evidence to the Republican-chaired House Judiciary Committee.
I was asked to come here to testify as to the educational situation in my hometown of Whitewater due to the large recent influx of non-English speakers.
At the Sweet Spot Cafe in that hometown, he told me what concerned him most.
There's a marked decline in educational outcomes, which kind of makes sense, right? I mean, if you have to spend more time translating to kids, you're going to have less favorable outcomes. The facts don't lie. This has nothing to do with race. It has to do with the fact that teachers have to deal with kids who don't speak English in the classroom with a bunch of kids who also do speak English. I have several friends who are teachers. It's a challenging situation. That's not a racial issue. It's an English issue.
And what impact has President Trump talking about this town had, do you think?
I think it's brought a focus on things that otherwise the city leaders didn't want. So I'm happy that Trump mentioned Whitewater because it forces Whitewater to admit that there are issues from the large number of immigrants, and then we can talk about how to deal with it instead of pretending that everything is great and the only people who have a problem with it are closet racists.
Do you think if President Trump is elected, then he will make a difference?
Well, he can't do worse. He can stop the influx. And at this point, I'd be happy for the bleeding to stop.
I've just entered the community space here in Whitewater. Just in front of me, there's a mountain of bagels being built on a table, all donations from a local store. A bright mural greets you. It says, "All are welcome here," in English and in Spanish. It's a place where members of the community, immigrants and others, can come and get free food, free household goods, free clothes, all of it donated. And there's also a classroom where English classes take place, and you can come here and get advice on immigration law.
I just had a woman come in with two bags of handmade mittens. She lives an hour away and brought us these mittens. What a godsend.
Kay Robers is the co-founder of the community space. She tells me that Donald Trump's comments about Whitewater have actually been helpful.
It's been wonderful because people are realizing that we're taking care of people and they want to be part of it. People are very generous with their donations.
This is the warehouse space at the back. Lots of people are bringing in donations, sorting them out. Among them is Pedro. He's been in the country for more than 3 decades. He helps out with the sorting, but also with the translation.
Today I helped one family. They was about a week here in the United States. They're looking for clothes for winter.
But as well as helping the new arrivals, Pedro says he's suffered because of their presence.
They see my color and my skin, and they stop me. The cap, they saw me.
He tells me he's been caught up in the police search for migrants driving without licenses. And for this Mexican-American, illegal immigration will be a key consideration when he votes.
Because we're working so hard and we pay taxes to help those people living in the hotels in Chicago, New York, not pay any penny. And we're working hard. They come from different country. I'm Mexico, but I think it's not right.
So you're a legal immigrant to this country and you are worried about people who are coming here illegally?
Yes. And Trump say they can stop that.
So you're leaning towards Trump?
A little bit.
But you will decide on the day? Will you on Tuesday?
I wait till last minute.
As Whitewater comes together to celebrate its local football team, it's clear that the town is still grappling with the challenge of immigration, an issue that has thrust it into the national spotlight and could determine the outcome of Tuesday's election.
Well, I'm joined here in Solly's in northern Milwaukee by Philip Rocco, who's Associate Professor of Political Science at Marquette University in Milwaukee. Philip, welcome to the program. Let's start with immigration. Is it a relatively recent issue here in Wisconsin?
No, I think it's been sort of on the minds of voters for a while, but I think Trump kind of brought it to light and continued to emphasize it. If you look at what voters say is a kind of most important issue in Wisconsin in our statewide polls, the economy tends to still top that list. Immigration is a really distant third. But for Republicans, the issue, really largely thanks to Trump, is still pretty prominent.
Yeah, and when it comes to Trump, we had Barack Obama, perhaps the, one of the biggest Democratic surrogates in this city yesterday. He was talking, it struck me, I was there talking about Donald Trump much more than he was talking about Kamala Harris, trying to sort of call him someone who doesn't have the concept of a plan, talking about him essentially being only out for himself, which is part of the Harris campaign as well. I mean, issues like immigration, economy versus character in this election. What's your sense of how it's playing out?
Well, I think that for a lot of voters, they don't necessarily make a separation in their mind because the person who's going to be in the White House dealing with the issues that they are, you know, confronting is a person that might have one kind of character or another. And I think that values ultimately matter to voters, especially people who are, you know, not necessarily paying attention to every single nuance of public policy. They know what a person talks like, they know the kinds of arguments they make and the sort of the way that they are in the world. And I think that for Democrats who have been making inroads in suburban counties in Wisconsin that had been Republican strongholds for a long time, it's things like that, in addition to issues like abortion, that are really have the potential to turn the tide.
I wanted to come on to abortion because it struck me being here over the past week that lots, pretty much every woman who was leaning towards the Democrats was saying to me that that is important, a lot of young women in particular. Young men, though, we spoke to quite a few. Quite a few of them seem to be leaning towards Donald Trump. Is there a sort of gender split that you're noticing?
Yeah, there is a gender divide in vote, a kind of across age bands, around 59% of women statewide and 41% of men, to 41% of men support Harris. So I think, there is a big gender divide. But I think that the salience of abortion has been really significant in the state after the Dobbs decision, which overturned Roe versus Wade. There was an 1849 law on the books that seemed to bring back an abortion ban in the state. Now, that law has been stayed. There's litigation in the courts about whether or not it's even enforceable or whether or not it's even an abortion ban. But there is a lack of access to abortion care in the state, and it's pretty clear that Dobbs accentuated that.
You're not a pollster, so you can probably talk more freely about this. The polls have been very wrong in Wisconsin in the last two elections, haven't they? What is your sense this time? They are saying very, very close again.
Well, I think that very, very close is quite a safe place to be. The last presidential election in Wisconsin was decided by 20,000 votes. And I think that what that means practically is pick any demographic that's potentially marginal or could add a significant chunk of votes to the final total, and you have a potentially pivotal demographic. There's 160,000 college students in the state. You know, even a tiny fraction
tiny
of them
fractions.
Could
it's
make
all
the,
down to tiny fractions. Philip Rocco from Marquette University, thanks very much. I'm going to enjoy a sip of Kim's rather wonderful steaming coffee. I'll be back later on in the program, but for now from Wisconsin, you're listening to NewsHour.
Thank you, Jamie. Yes, and he will be back later on from Wisconsin with the race so tight. We'll be speaking to the person responsible for the smooth and secure running of the election there in that critical swing state.
2020 happens and everything is different. The attacks on the election system, the attacks on democracy, we had never seen anything like that before. Certainly leading into January 6th and the attacks on the Capitol. And I think that has really changed how we look at elections here in Wisconsin.
More on that to come later this hour. Other headlines, the UN Agency for Palestinian Refugees has warned that Israel's ban on its activities is likely to cause the collapse of humanitarian operations in the Gaza Strip. You're listening to NewsHour live from the BBC. Moldova's pro-EU president Maia Sandu has been re-elected with 55% of the vote. She's been receiving warm congratulations from leaders across the EU today. Her opponent, Alexander Stoyanoglu, who was backed by the pro-Russian Party of Socialists, secured 44% of the votes. This election, like several others in that part of the world, has been seen as the big choice, really, between looking towards Moscow or the EU for kinship. This tiny ex-Soviet republic is nestled between Romania and Ukraine. It's got a population of about 2.5 million and an expat population population of over a million who were allowed to vote in these elections. And today, German officials said that Moldovans voting there had been subject to intimidation to prevent them voting. Let's speak to Anna Gurcio, who's a Moldovan journalist. She runs the journalism website moldova.org. Anna, first of all, why is this election, why has it been seen as so crucial to the future of the country?
Hello, and thank you for having me. Well, let's consider the geopolitical context in which we found ourselves. We are physically two steps away from the war started by Russia against Ukraine. We have a pro-European party and pro-European president who, together with the civil society and the entire population of the Republic of Moldova, have managed to face the crisis that followed, and I'm referring here especially to the economic one and the access to the gas. Russia's interest in dominating the authorities and all our reality in the Republic of Moldova has grown considerably for the last few years. And in the last few weeks, a lot of information have been published regarding the methods of infiltration and involvement of the employees of the Russian forces in the elections of Republic of Moldova. And the large number of the counter candidates in the first round of the presidential elections, as well as the campaign to discourage voting in the referendum on their part, is also an evidence.
So, and we've also had this line from the Germans today saying that there were bomb threats at polling stations in Germany for Moldovans voting there. Ursula von der Leyen, EU president, has been saying that President Maya Sandu had put up with great challenges going into this. I mean, even though it does look like a convincing win for President Sandu, there's still a sizable number who did vote for the pro-Russia opposition. Is the country dangerously divided at the moment?
Well, as I was saying, there's a lot of information that we found out recently. For example, the past week we found out, the journalists from Zarul de Garde, the investigative journalists, they infiltrated the groups organized by Ilan Shor, that's an oligarch accused for stealing a lot of money from our banks. And they discovered how they organized voters and convinced them by paying them to vote against Maya Sandu. So actually the statistics, the results of the elections in the census, but also in the first tour and second, are not realistic.
All right. Well, thank you so much for updating us there live from Moldova. Anna Gurcio there. Tributes have been pouring in from across the world for the American composer, songwriter and music producer Quincy Jones, who's died. He was 91 and died last night at home in Bel Air, Los Angeles, surrounded by his family. Quincy Jones was probably one of the most prolific musicians whose work spanned an incredible 70-odd years. He worked with all the greats, including Ray Charles, Chaka Khan and many others.
Fly me to the moon, let me play among the stars, and let me see what spring is like on Jupiter and Mars.
Frank Sinatra, Michael Jackson, and many of the stars who sang on that charity record, We Are the World, there. Well, earlier I caught up with jazz pianist Julian Joseph, who worked with Quincy Jones. So what was he like?
I had the great opportunity to meet him about 7 years ago at the Montreux Jazz Festival. I'd gone over there especially to do an interview with him. And as you can imagine, a man of his stature, it was quite a challenge to get his attention for 15 minutes, let alone the 40 minutes I ended up speaking to him. He told me that, you know, he grew up in Chicago and it was pretty rough. You know, he was often getting into trouble and his family moved out to Seattle. And this is where he connected with Ray Charles, and he got very, very serious about music. So yeah, music was really the key to unlocking what has become such a beautiful and rich and fruitful life. He was a really warm and friendly person. What I could feel when I was speaking to him was that he had this wonderful way with people. And I think that's what made him such a giant producer and such a legend in that field and many other fields too.
Yeah, that's really interesting that you highlight that, because he did work with so many artists and some of the biggest artists, you know, in the past century, but they were very diverse, weren't they, in terms of sound? So he was such a musical influence on their work and how they ended up sounding. Talk us through some of the examples.
He'd come up through as a jazz musician, so he played in the orchestra of Lionel Hampton, the great vibraphone player who worked with Benny Goodman, and then he'd worked with Frank Sinatra through his connection with Count Basie, because he became Count Basie's arranger. I mean, that led on to him being a vice president of the Mercury Records Company, and then he produced It's My Party and I'll Cry If I Want To by Leslie Gore, which sold millions. The big one, which everybody I know is going to recognize and know, is that he produced Michael Jackson's great albums, Off the Wall, Thriller, which is the biggest selling album in history. And then further into time, he'd set up a production company, and so he was responsible for many great TV shows, including The Fresh Prince of Bel-Air, which starred Will Smith, so he brought him to prominence. He was a big producer on The Color Purple, which brought Whoopi Goldberg and Oprah Winfrey to prominence.
It's really amazing, isn't it? And I mean, the fact that he had such a long career in in an industry that moves all the time, and where the trends come in and out, he was never stuck in one age, was he?
He
was working till fairly recently. What would be his sort of more modern stuff?
In recent times, he was working with the great New Orleans pianist and composer and vocalist John Batiste, who's getting a lot of love from the world today, and also our wonderful powerhouse musician from England called Jacob Collier. He was a big champion of those two guys, and it doesn't stop. I mean, he champions new artists all the time, and it's just a testament to his insight into music, his need to encourage, and his people whispering skills, as I like to put it.
Jazz pianist Julian Joseph speaking to us earlier about the life and work of Quincy Jones, who has died at the age of 91. That news just breaking this morning, and many tributes have been paid to what a great musician he was. Welcome back to NewsHour. On the eve of the US election, BBC Verify has been looking at some of the rumours, misleading allegations and outright lies on the subject of voting and fraud that seem to be flooding online spaces. Verify's Merlin Thomas is part of the team that's been looking into the claims.
Videos have been circulating online claiming to show problems with voting in Pennsylvania. In Bucks County in eastern Pennsylvania, several videos claim to show access to voting sites being restricted. A Bucks County spokesperson told BBC Verify that mail-in ballot queues can be cut off if there are too many people to process before the office closes. The deadline for registering for mail-in ballots in the state was on October the 29th, when most of these claims came to a crescendo. But a judge has since extended this deadline for Bucks County voters to November the 1st, after Trump took legal action against the county. And there are also widespread claims of voter registration fraud, which Trump has highlighted. As Election Day gets closer and more claims surface about the integrity of the election, officials are keen to emphasise that this election can still be trusted.
Well, over the past few days, we've been looking at some of the different terminology, jargon, basically, that may creep into the coverage over the next few days as we all try to describe the electoral process. Our veteran US watcher and former BBC Washington correspondent Nick Bryant has made a little jargon-busting mini-series for us on the US election and explainers. Today's subject is voter suppression. So what is it?
Voter suppression is as old as America itself. Indeed, the founding fathers were masters at it. They never liked the idea of a mass democracy. Some even spoke of an excess of democracy. So in the early years of the United States, the franchise was largely limited to white men of property. The states were left to decide their own voting qualifications. Genuine universal suffrage only came about in the mid-1960s. Yes, you heard that right. With the passage of the landmark 1965 Voting Rights Act. Finally, after the protests of the civil rights movement, African Americans in the southern states were allowed to vote unhindered. No longer were they subject to literacy tests, where they were asked unanswerable questions, such as how many bubbles were in a bar of soap. However, the ink on the new legislation had barely dried before new ways were found of barring people of color, especially from voting. In recent decades, the Republican Party has ramped up its campaign of voter suppression. In Georgia, for instance, the Republican-controlled state legislature made it a crime to provide water and food for those waiting in line to vote. This law was thought to be targeted at people of color because the queues at polling stations in largely black neighborhoods tend to be longer than those in the largely white suburbs. As Barack Obama once observed, we're the only advanced democracy that deliberately discourages people from voting.
And that was Nick Bryant there, former BBC correspondent and author of the book The Forever War, America's Unending Conflict with Itself. You're listening to NewsHour live from the BBC. I'm Rebecca Kesby in London, and we'll be back with James Kumarasamy in Wisconsin later in the programme. First, though, to a story that's been emerging in Israel over the weekend. Did Israeli government leaks compromise hostage negotiations? And does Benjamin Netanyahu's own office have questions to answer? On Friday, a court in Israel disclosed the arrest of several people in connection to an alleged leak of classified information, which it said may have harmed the achievement of Israel's war aims. There's a partial gag order on the details, but it's believed that one of those arrested is Mr. Netanyahu's own spokesman, Eli Feldstein. Well, the allegations suggest that classified documents were taken, amended, allegedly to better fit the government agenda, and then leaked to members of the press. The political implications could be substantial. Speaking at a news conference, a leading opposition figure, Yair Lapid, said that an inquiry is needed to determine if Mr. Netanyahu had ordered the leak.
This affair originated in the Prime Minister's office, and the investigation needs to determine whether or not it was under the Prime Minister's orders. If Netanyahu knew, he is complicit in one of the most serious security breaches on record. If Netanyahu did not know, then what does he know?
Well, the fear that the action may have jeopardised hostage negotiations is also alarming the families of those still being held captive by Hamas. As I mentioned, there are legal restrictions on the details, but earlier I spoke to Eliav Breuer, who's a journalist with the Jerusalem Post. He's covering this, so what do we know so far?
A member of the Prime Minister's office's team, spokesperson's team or media team, is under an investigation of the Shin Bet, which is kind of Israel's, like, the equivalent of the FBI. So he's been arrested along with three or four other security officials whose names are still under gag order. This is a serious security breach. This has to do with certain documents that were leaked that were top secret, that were not approved to go out. And what the most important part of the story is that these leaks had to do with ongoing negotiations for a hostage deal. And from what we understand, part of the purpose of these leaks was to attempt to strengthen the Prime Minister's narrative that it was the other side that wasn't interested in a hostage deal, which means essentially that the Prime Minister of Israel himself was leaking highly classified information in order to prevent a hostage deal out of fear that it would bring down his government.
Now, these are very serious allegations, and it seems to all be connected to a period in September when the bodies of some hostages were found at that point. And it was also when the government was under intense pressure to get a deal to end the fighting at that point.
That's correct. It had to do with, at the beginning of September, six bodies of hostages who were being held by Hamas in Gaza were extracted from the Gaza Strip, and they had just been executed a few days before after surviving about 10 months in captivity. That caused a huge uproar on the Israeli street because there was a fear that these people could have been returned earlier in earlier deals. The public uproar led to public pressure on the prime minister and anger to try to push through a deal almost at any cost. The prime minister convened a press conference, which he rarely does, with Israeli press, and kind of presented his thesis, which was that there were some conditions that were being set by Hamas that were not acceptable from an Israeli security standpoint. One of them being that Hamas was demanding that Israel give up its presence along what we call the Philadelphia Corridor, which is the border between Gaza and Egypt. One of the leaked documents, or allegedly leaked documents, claimed that Hamas was smuggling hostages out of Gaza and into Egypt. And this strengthened the prime minister's claim that the Philadelphia Corridor was important and that it could not be given up on. Turns out that that document was false.
Yeah, so the allegation is that some of these documents may have been amended or changed slightly to kind of give a more favourable view of the government's policy at the time. I mean, the Haaretz newspaper is actually naming the alleged person thought to be involved from the media team, Eli Feldstein, and he only started working for Mr. Netanyahu shortly after the October the 7th attacks. Is it possible that he wouldn't have gone through the normal security checks if that was the case?
The name was permitted for publication yesterday. And interestingly, again, according to reports, this Eli Feldstein wasn't accepted to work officially in his capacity on the prime minister's media team because he didn't pass security clearances. Now, the prime minister's office still used his services as an outside advisor. Again, according to reports, he can be seen in a large number of pictures, official photographs that came out of the prime minister's office, and all kinds of visits to military bases and in high senior official meetings with top military brass.
So, I mean, obviously the political implications of this could be immense for the prime minister himself. But what are the possible legal implications if it is found that classified documents were taken, altered and leaked?
I think that's a great question. And this kind of harkens back to Watergate. There are a lot of people here making that comparison because the question is, how high up does this go? If this person, Eli Feldstein, did it on his own initiative, you know, to try to look good in the eyes of the boss, that's one thing. If the order came directly from the prime minister, then allegedly the prime minister himself could have committed a crime relating to, you know, one of the most serious crimes in the book of, you know, leaking state secrets for political purposes.
Politically, Mr. Netanyahu is under quite a lot of heat today from opposition figures, but also from members of the families of those that are still being held by Hamas.
Some of the hostage families are furious at the prime minister's conduct. They're furious that he isn't being held accountable. And this episode kind of fits in as a piece of that larger puzzle where it could be proof that the prime minister himself acted in order to prevent a deal that could have brought home their loved ones so as to preserve his government.
Eliav Breuer there from the Jerusalem Post. As Israel continues its intense bombardment of Lebanon, one of the main cities in the south, Nabatea, is now largely empty. It's estimated that only a few hundred people remain now from a pre-war population of about 80,000. Israel ordered the entire city to evacuate in early October. It says it's striking Hezbollah facilities, not the Lebanese people. Despite this, the city's main government hospital remains open and the emergency services are still operating. Our senior international correspondent, Ola Girin, reports from Nabatea now, and you may find some of what you hear quite distressing.
I'm standing in what is or was the old market area in Nabatea, the old souk. It dated from the Ottoman era. And now there's really just destruction in every direction. And over our heads, very loud, very low in the sky, an Israeli drone. It's been there for the past 10 or 15 minutes, and it continues to hover I'm with Hussein Jaber from the civil defense in Nabatea. The drone is over us. You hear this all the time?
We hear it 90% of the time, but it depends exactly where it is. Now we think it's right above us.
So they're watching us?
Most probably, yes. We don't care what they are watching. We care that we are here with our families and with every civilian in these difficult times.
Well, within the last few minutes, a patient has been rushed in, a woman. She's being treated here in the emergency department. You can hear now that she's in pain. She's a casualty of an airstrike that we heard just a few moments ago.
Where is it? That's not.
I'm on one of the hospital balconies now. There's just been another airstrike. I can see smoke rising in the distance just beyond the hill in front. We've been hearing planes in the sky. We've had one or two other explosions in the past hour or so. Staff here at the hospital say the airstrikes can come at any moment, day or night. And a short time later, we heard this massive strike. The Israeli army says it's targeting Hezbollah, not the Lebanese people. We're inside the burns unit in the hospital. There are three patients here now, all victims of airstrikes. Lying in front of me is Mohammed, who's 29. He's a civil engineer. His injuries are very visible. He has severe burns to his face. He has bandages around his chest where he has third-degree burns. And he was injured trying to bring food to a neighbour.
The airstrike at the house right beside us. It was very close, about 5 meters away. It was all black, smoke everywhere. I took like about 1 minute, then I started to recognize what is around me. So my friends, started talking to them, and I knew they were still alive.
And there was no warning before this strike?
No one, not at all. Not to us, not to our neighbors, not to the person inside the house that was hit. No.
The area that was hit, was this completely a civilian area?
All civilians, yes. The person who died actually is a policeman.
We're driving through Nabatea now. Flattened, crushed buildings in every direction. Empty streets, boarded up shops. And almost no people. We've seen two people on the streets in the past hour. Everywhere there is broken glass, smashed shop fronts, rubble. It's been turned into a ghost city. And if and when people try to return, there'll be so much damage to repair.
Orla Guerin reporting, and she joins us live now. Orla, how close is Israel to achieving its goals in Lebanon?
Well, there's been a great deal of destruction and loss of life in Lebanon over the past 5 weeks since the Israeli ground invasion began. According to the Lebanese Health Ministry, 2,200 people have been killed here in that time by Israeli strikes. The ministry doesn't give a breakdown between civilians and Hezbollah fighters. But Israel has not achieved its aim. It said it invaded here to stop Hezbollah firing rockets across the border to get its people back to their homes.
And a reminder of our top story this hour. Kamala Harris and Donald Trump are making a final push for votes on the eve of the U.S. presidential election in the swing state of Wisconsin. Philip Rocco, Associate Professor of Political Science at Marquette University in Milwaukee, gave his view on what the most important things are for the people of Wisconsin.
If you look at what voters say is the kind of most important issue in Wisconsin in our statewide polls, the economy tends to still top that list. Immigration is a really distant third. But for Republicans, the issue really largely thanks to Trump is still pretty prominent.
More from Milwaukee in just a moment. Our other headline this hour, the UN Agency for Palestinian Refugees has warned that Israel's ban on its activities is likely to cause the collapse of humanitarian operations in the Gaza Strip. This is NewsHour live from the BBC with me, Rebecca Kesby, in London and James Kamarasamy in Wisconsin.
Yes, welcome back to Solly's Grill. I'm fortified with a cup or two of bottomless coffee here served by Kim, and the customers are still arriving. I'm rather enviously looking at some of the breakfast plates that have been cleared. I'm sure I'll have time for brunch a bit later on. But let's turn to the election and perhaps to the way it is actually being organised, because that's become such an important thing here in America. On Sunday, Donald Trump said he was ready for a stolen election. And one of the many unprecedented aspects of this vote is the fact that one of the candidates still doesn't publicly acknowledge he lost the last one. And after what happened in 2020, more attention than ever is being paid to how the voting is happening and how the votes are being counted. Now, the person who's responsible for the smooth and secure running of the election in this state is the Democrat, Ann Jacobs. She's chair of the Wisconsin Elections Commission. It's a position that rotates between the two parties every couple of years. She actually held that position 4 years ago as well. I asked her, how was that experience?
It was jarring and a bit surreal. 2016, Donald Trump won Wisconsin. We had a statewide recount. He still won Wisconsin. We had a Democratic chair of the Elections Commission who certified his election, and that was what we did. And there were some issues, there always are in every election, but it wasn't anything extraordinary. 2020 happens, and everything is different. The attacks on the election system, the attacks on democracy, we had never seen anything like that before, certainly leading into January 6th and the attacks on the Capitol. And I think that has really changed how we look at elections here in Wisconsin.
You were in the eye of the storm then. You were in this role in 2020. What was that experience like for you personally?
There were moments that it was concerning. Certainly, I remember specifically one person posted a photograph of my home and on social media and said, I wonder where her children go to school. So that was the sort of level of vitriol and the like, and there were others that were worse, that really changed how we look at this process. At the same time, the importance of being a part of this process and administering it fairly in accordance with the law is essential for our democracy. And so those other matters notwithstanding, we have to move forward.
What are you expecting, given this atmosphere you're describing? What are you expecting on election night and beyond?
I think some of it is going to depend on how the numbers shake out across the country. If we're seeing reports from the East Coast, which closes their elections much earlier than we do, showing a significant Harris win or lead, I think that may take some of the sails, wind out of the sails here in Wisconsin for the people who want to attack the process. That said, I am anticipating a lot of folks trying to interfere with the process during the day on November 5th by making spurious challenges against voters, against forms, against envelopes. So I am expecting that. I hope to be wrong. I'm always optimistic, but I certainly am expecting that behavior.
Ann Jacobs, chair of the Wisconsin Elections Commission. Well, joining us on the line from Philadelphia and the other swing state of Pennsylvania is Albert Eisenberg, Republican political strategist. Welcome to NewsHour, Albert. When you hear the chair of an elections commission being threatened with a guillotine, what do you think?
I think that there's a lot of political violence on both sides and political rhetoric that's leading to violence on both sides. Kamala Harris and Tim Walz have spent the better half of the last couple weeks comparing Trump supporter and Trump himself to Nazis, which is pretty heated rhetoric. And Hillary Clinton and her media supporters spent the first 3 years of Trump's term pretending that Russia had somehow bought and paid for our prior election, which was completely debunked.
Well, that's different.
So
with all due respect, it's different. It's different to the kind of language that Donald Trump is using. He's talking about shooting. He's talking about bloodshed. Of course, he was shot himself during this election campaign.
Yes.
It's not a way to calm things down. It doesn't seem to augur well for this post-election period, does it?
No, but I guess my point is it's coming from the left as much as it's coming from the right, and there's a class of people that seem to pretend that it's only a problem when it comes from the right. My wager is that Trump's going to win Pennsylvania and the United States presidential election, and that Democrats are going to have plenty of violent street action afterwards, and I will be very curious whether the media will be picking up on that, because it worries a lot of voters. They see it.
Yeah, well, violence, I think, worries everyone everywhere.
Yes.
But, I mean, just on what you've said there about Donald Trump winning, I mean, key to winning it, well, there's all sorts of keys, aren't there? But given that you're in Philadelphia, I wonder what you think of him cutting into the urban vote, which has traditionally been very Democratic, African-Americans, Latinos, young people. I mean, the polls suggest, yes, he has improved amongst all of those. What are you seeing?
Yes, fascinating trends, and ones that I think echo across the ocean to the UK as well, with the breaking of the red wall in 2019 by the Tories. There's a working class shift of all backgrounds towards Republicans. It's been occurring for the last decade or so. Trump has accelerated that trend, and you can expect in Pennsylvania a consequential shift among Hispanic voters, among Jewish voters, among Black voters to the right. And I believe that will decide the state of Pennsylvania. And it's happening as the Democrats are sort of doubling down on what you'd call an elite, race-focused policy, and yet racially diverse voters are shifting Republican.
Yeah, I mean, why do you think that's happening? Is it the economy? Donald Trump does, and I think, you know, even a partisan like you would say he veers in many, many directions during his stump speeches, some of them not entirely logical. But he does talk about that question that's often a very traditional one. Are you better off now than you were 4 years ago? Does it come down to that? Does it come down to the economy?
Absolutely. It always does, because most voters are not professional partisans, as you mentioned. They're just people trying to pay their bills and get along and live their lives in their communities. So when you see the price of groceries, gas, material goods going up so much, and rent and it being unaffordable to live due to inflationary spending, the current administration, which Harris has at some points distanced herself from and at some points said she's, you know, wouldn't have done anything better, clearly voters are going to associate her with the economic trends, and I think they deserve to, and that's why I think she's going to lose.
We will see, obviously, tomorrow or perhaps in the days following. Albert Eisenberg, Republican political strategist from Philadelphia there.
Jamie, it is the big day, isn't it, tomorrow? Election day, finally. Where are you going to be?
We're going to be popping around the suburbs of this city, Milwaukee, these areas which Kamala Harris is hoping to make inroads into, where there are large numbers of Republican voters, Donald Trump hoping to hang on. We will be talking to voters of all stripes on election day. More than 78 million, of course, have already voted, but there are plenty out there to talk to on Tuesday as well. For now, though, that is it from NewsHour, from Rebecca Kesby in London and me, James Kamara-Sami, in Milwaukee in the U.S. state of Wisconsin. Thanks very much for listening.